welcome to the Weekside Podcast. I'm Jenny Brentis. I'm here in studio with Connor Orr. We're going to start off this week with the elephant in the room. Most of you have seen the news about widespread layoffs at Sports Illustrated. In the newsroom, we lost close to 40% of our full-time staff. There's no other way to describe this week than somber. So I wanted to go over a few of the colleagues that we lost. There were dozens of good people across the newsroom, too many to name individually on this podcast. So we'll give a shout to our MMQB colleagues. First of all, executive editor Mark Moravec. The MMQB would not exist without Mark. He and Peter were co-founders of this venture back in 2013. And in addition to being a fantastically smart editor, he's been a voice of reason, a sounding board, a support system, and a really great friend. He also can debate anyone in the world on VAR. And if you do not believe me, you can find his Twitter feed at Mark Moravec, M-R-A-V-I-C, and please debate him on it. Andy Benoit, who knows so much about football, he has had job offers from NFL teams. He introduced the world, and specifically the Rams, to Sean McVay. So in a world where McVay is a job reference, remember that Andy Benoit was Sean McVay's job reference. That's pretty remarkable. Tim Rowan, who had moved to the college football beat this year, but we claim him because he started with us. Tim did the podcast re-examining the Steve McNair case, which sets a standard here at Sports Illustrated and in the business at large for a sports true crime podcast. Maybe a lesser known piece of his, though, but one that I thought was among his best work here, was the story he did on Juan, a student who is a U.S. citizen, but some members of his family are not. So he lives in Mexico and would cross the border each day to go to school and play football in Brownsville, Texas. It was a really human portrait of life on the border, and it was so good that the story was later copied by other outlets. And John DiPietro, another founding member of the MMQB, he was our go-to videographer through training camp tours and at the Super Bowl and when our RV got stuck in a field at the Jamestown Jammers game. All great journalists, even better people, and it's heart-wrenching to move forward without them. To be quite frank, we do not know what the future holds at SI. We know that our newsroom and our reputation has taken a devastating hit. The one thing I do know, though, is that those of us here are going to keep fighting for the quality and the standards and the integrity that this brand has represented for 65 years. And we are going to keep doing the Weekside Podcast every Wednesday for as long as we can.
Beautifully put, Jenny. I really don't think, you know, it's hard to add much there, but, you know, I had the pleasure of working with Tim and Mark and Andy, and, you know, they're just the best, you know. You know, there's 1,000 good stories you could list off that Tim and Andy have done, and Mark, who hired me here. You know, it's just it's been a tough week, you know, and but you know, it's good to move forward knowing, you know, how much support and how many good things that we were a part of with them, you know, and how many good things we were able to see them do. And I'm sure we're going to see them do them elsewhere soon, you know.
Absolutely, Connor.
Well, there's no, I guess, easy way to get into the news of the week, but, you know, inevitably it was a busy NFL weekend, and we know that's why you're here. Thanks for sticking with us through this. The Raiders, you know, if you're a listener of this podcast, you know my thoughts on sort of the building process there and how everything's going. I stamped my Oracle prediction last week on this game, which did come true, so a little bit of a silver lining here, but the Raiders edge the Bears in London, adding another surprise twist to their initially rocky but somehow functional 2019 campaign. The game seemed to hinge on a play where Khalil Mack recovered a fumble dropped by Josh Jacobs, the rookie who he was ostensibly traded for. Poetic justice. We're all going to kind of go home feeling good about that, but then the Raiders staved off a total meltdown. After the game, Gruden made fun of the Bears in their post-game routine. He threw shade at their pass rush. Jenny, what the hell is going on?
You put that topic perfectly, Connor. And yes, the Oracle was correct this week. Khalil Mack was triple teamed for a large portion
yes.
of the football game.
The first play of the game was a designed rollout away from Khalil Mack. So Derek Carr was probably like, you know, in lateral yards, probably about 10 yards away from Khalil Mack. And there was three guys on him. Like, that to me embodies the overkill, right?
Right. The point that he was trying to make, evidently, is Khalil Mack is one player, and you can always neutralize one player. So we were in the right by trading him away and saying that we didn't want a piece him to be a piece of our rebuilding process.
Yeah.
I disagree with that sentiment for the record, but that was clearly the intent.
You know, what was amazing to me, though, is that there were plays, you know, three guys devoted to him. A lot of plays where it was, you know, your standard, you know, using a tight end to chip. But then there was also a lot of plays where you're just devoting another interior offensive lineman to almost shade the tackle and to follow him around and make sure that everything's going okay. But I was stunned at the amount of resources that they put towards just Khalil Mack, that they were able to run the ball effectively and move the football against one of the best defenses in the league. Like, normally, if you hamstring yourself that way, you're making yourself a lot less viable offensively, but somehow they put points on the board.
Right. The Raiders have been something of a surprise early this season. They have been better than we thought. They have, you know, pulled off some surprising victories, this one included. I'm still not ready to say they've done anything at this point. We still don't know. The way they were celebrating this game, as you described it, like they were winning the Super Bowl, a win against a team led by a backup quarterback in London, right? Mm-hmm. So I think this was, you run the risk of it being so personally satisfying for a coach and building up to a week five game. And then for what?
Yeah. I put it, you know, I had asked to write about this game, and so I was locked in. I was very excited about it. And when the moment that Khalil Mack recovered the fumble, I thought we rarely get poetic justice anymore, right? That just sweet, tucked in feeling of, you know, that fable or parable. It's like, this is wrong and this is right, and here's how we're showing you that it's wrong and right. And I thought we were getting it. And I don't know, am I making too much of it to say that maybe this is the death of poetic justice? Like, it's over. We're just not going to get it anymore.
This week, I would probably go along with any doom and gloom storylines that you would present my way, Connor. I will be frank about that. But listen, give Raiders a credit. They had a good win. They're off to a better start than they expected. We'll see where they go from here. That's where I stand right now, Connor.
Yeah, I'm interested to see, you know, kind of your thoughts here, bye week, and then Packers, Texans, and Lions for them, leading us into November. I don't know. What do you think? That's a tough road ahead.
That's a tough road ahead. We knew their early schedule overall was pretty tough. So I think to say that they would have been 3-2 in this juncture, we probably wouldn't have guessed that, right?
Yeah.
That's better than expected.
Yeah, I would have had maybe an O.
O and five?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I predicted all the games for the magazine back in the summer, and I don't think I had them 0-5. I think I might have had them 1-4. And then the Antonio Brown thing happened, and then Vontaze Burfict gets kicked off the team. Just so much, you know. And I will say this, I don't think that they're done solving all of their internal issues. Richie Incognito had two personal foul penalties on Sunday, both of which knocked them out of field goal range. They ended up getting back in on the second one. I mean, this team makes no sense to me from a functional standpoint. I don't know.
Yeah, I think our questions about how they built this team are still really valid. And yeah, you know, I think the perfect situation and what you just described with Incognito they're very Raiders-esque players, right?
Yes.
Players who are getting their last chance in Oakland, as opposed to other teams who wouldn't take them on. But I still, just because they had this, you know, emotional win against the Bears, now they've got to, you know, keep backing this up, right? I mean, it's one thing to pour a ton of emotion into a game in London, which is always kind of weird, against Chase Daniel. It's another thing to sustain that. So that'll be where the true test is, Connor.
Another interesting question, too, is whether the Bears are going to scare a lot of teams off just arriving on Friday again, you know, because we've seen teams approach it differently.
Yes.
You know, a lot of interesting stuff there.
Topic number two, Sam Darnold's spleen is no longer at critical mass. Wow, Connor, that was a good one. Okay, I'm really, really, okay, excellent. This, after the Jets were roundly and embarrassingly drubbed by the Eagles. Do you think Adam Gase gets a pass in 2019 given all the turmoil, or does he need to show something with Darnold in these remaining 11 games to come back? First of all, shout out to Brian Costello from the New York Post for breaking the Darnold story.
Very
on
good
Tuesday
job
morning.
There, Brian.
Great reporting. Friend of the podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely think Adam Gase should get a pass in 2019. I understand there are legitimate concerns, but it's not like he's stumbling with Trevor Siemian even, right?
Right.
I mean, we see a lot of, you say, okay, look at the Colts. They lose their franchise quarterback, you know, right before the season begins, and they're still thriving with Jacoby Brissett. But Jacoby Brissett's been a player who's been there for a few years and has had time to develop. And I think in the case of Adam Gase, you know, he's on a third-string quarterback. It's not what he planned for. This is his first year with the team. He hasn't had a ton of time with these players anyway. I think the criticism of him has gotten off to a swift start, and I can't say that I agree with it. Now, I know the flip side to that is people will say, well, in Miami, the defensive Gase always was. He didn't have Ryan Tannehill for half the games that he coached, and he never did anything without him. So I understand that people are probably predisposed to be skeptical of that defense, but I am not ready to write this off, and I think the extreme remaking of the organization, right? You know, bringing in Joe Douglas, a guy that he knows, and sort of charting a new path with this new regime, they're definitely going to give him time.
Yeah, I think you need time. And, you know, I think it's just one of those things that this has been a series of really difficult events for Adam if he was interested in rebuilding his reputation in the media there. I don't know if he is or with the fans, but, you know, to have the Maccagnan thing happen the way that it did, and then you start out by losing a few games, and, you know, you can't control when your quarterback gets mono or anything like that. But it has been just a series of difficult events. I will say that I do think that there's going to be a heightened awareness of Darnold's progress moving forward, which I do think is another thing that's tough for Adam Gase, because this is a guy that's coming off of an issue, you know, a health-related issue that does make you tired, that does make you, it's harder for you to get ready to compete on the field, and yet we're all going to be kind of micromanaging or micro-analyzing that process now for the remaining 11 games this season.
I did think where he made a mistake was the rhetoric last week, making it sound like Darnold would play, and in what seemed like an accelerated timeline. I was surprised to read that last week that he might have been ready for the Eagles game. And then, of course, he wasn't. So I think you could certainly criticize the public presentation of some of the things that Gase has said, right? And I think perhaps that is why some of the criticism has really, like, charged out of the station.
What recovery in New York are you more impressed by, Saquon Barkley's bionic ankle or Sam Darnold's rather rapid recovery from mono? I remember the kids that in my high school or middle school that got mono, it was like they disappeared, you know, for like, and you just didn't see them again.
When I had mono, I was like not very functional as an employee for like 3 months in a job that does not require physical exertion. So this to me, this does seem quite rapid, Connor. I also remember calling my boss right after I had received word that I had mono, and he returned my call after a voicemail and noted that I sounded like Chewbacca. So that is something I will always remember. I'm more impressed with Darnold's recovery. We've seen players come back from a high ankle sprain after 3 weeks.
Yes.
I think it was just because they put the 6 to 8 week timetable on it, which was probably smart by the Giants to lower expectations about when he would return.
Right.
And just add to the, now we're getting into conspiracy theories. I wasn't even expecting to go down this route.
I just rub off on
you. But they're just trying to add to the legend by setting an unfairly long timetable for his return.
It was,
wow.
You know who would love this? is Tom Coughlin, right? He would love the idea of a player coming back before a projected injury timetable. Like, I remember when I covered the team, I think it was 2013 or 2014, and Steve Weatherford, the punter, got hurt. And you remember Steve was like at the bodybuilder, right?
Yeah.
So he was always about the nutrition and the fitness and everything like that. And I asked Tom, like, he got seriously injured in a game once, and we were all trying to find out, you know, who they were going to sign at punter, and they weren't signing anybody. And I was like, I saw him. I don't think he can walk. Like, what's going on? And he ended up punting in that game on Sunday, the following Sunday, and playing really well. And I asked Tom, it was the only time that he ever smiled when I asked him a question in a year and a half. Most of the time, just didn't really like when I asked him a question. But he said, do you think it's his physical fitness that somehow led him back to the field? And he just started glowing. And he's like, yes. And this is an example of just preparation and body management. And I just think that Tom Coughlin would have loved this. Like, this is just something he would have absolutely eaten up.
This is a shining moment.
That's great, Connor.
That's a great story.
All right. Moving on, because, you know, I'm already getting us off track here. But Monday Night Football, so we're recording this on Tuesday, which is, so we were watching Monday Night Football. We were up late last night digesting all we could from this 49ers-Browns matchup, which is not much of a game. And we could have, you know, I could have really dived into Words with Friends at halftime and been okay with that, you know, and just missed the second half. There's some minor handshake controversies that I'm not quite 100% interested in. We can get into that if you'd like to get into that. But they're one of two remaining undefeated teams in the NFL right now. And I put after thunder punching the Browns on Monday Night Football.
Thunder punch.
Mark Schlereth used that word in the Bears-Raiders game at halftime. He said that Oakland came out and thunder-punched Chicago for 30 minutes.
Oh, so you're reclaiming the word after negative usage.
Yeah,
I see.
So I'm going to try to take it back. It was a great word, though, so credit to Mark Schlereth there. 49ers defense looks like it's for real. The running game looks absolutely exceptional. This seemed like a pivot point for two franchises that are, you know, maybe headed in very different directions after several splashy off seasons. So I don't know. What do you think?
I'm convinced. I'm in on the 49ers. Their early schedule had been pretty easy. Buccaneers, Bengals, a Roethlisberger-less Steelers, and then the Browns. So I was not entirely sold. But this game was, I think, really on the national stage saying, hey, the 49ers are finally pretty good.
I love that 1-2-3-4-5 punch at running back. I mean, that is they might have, at the beginning of the season, I was scolded by a colleague, not in an SI colleague, but a colleague in the football writing world, for saying that I thought the Eagles had the deepest backfield maybe that I'd ever seen in football. And I think it might be the 49ers. I mean, after all that, I was thinking, you know, Miles Sanders and Jordan Howard and Darren Sproles, like, how are you going to compete with that? How are you going to match up with that? I think San Francisco poses just as many, if not more, challenges. I mean, Matt Breida has been phenomenal over the last few weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And we always know the Shanahans are like these great run game architects,
yep,
right? So, but that was really fun to watch. That was a fun display. Now, on the other side of the field, not so fun times for the Browns.
Oracle prediction from week two is,
yes,
still intact.
It is still alive. What was your window again?
I said that by Thanksgiving, Freddie Kitchens would relent play calling.
Oh,
duties.
Okay. We've got a lot of time.
We've got a lot of time.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we've said it before. I don't know how much new there is to add, but the sort of rebuild overlooked the offensive line, and I think we're seeing the effects of it now.
Do you think that, and you know, here's where I will bring the handshake controversy in. For those of you who have not seen it, Richard Sherman told NFL.com that he was miffed about the fact that that Baker Mayfield didn't shake his hand during the pregame when all the captains went to midfield. Video has since surfaced that he did shake his hand, but this is a Seahawks thing, right? I mean, Richard Sherman is a big, like, you've disrespected me kind of, I mean, sort of a propelling momentum kind of thing anyway, right?
Right.
So I will say that the handshake was not hearty. It was not friendly. It was more of a, like, a quick
limp
slap, like a limp slap.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like that. Yeah. For those of you who can't see us, Jenny and I are just like wobbling our wrists at each other right now in the studio. But this was the first time that I've seen sort of the facade around Baker kind of start crumbling down, right?
Yeah.
Because he had that amazing run during his rookie season, and he came into the league hot, right? Like, I'm going to take this team back. I'm going to bring this team back. I deserve to be number one. Nick Bosa planting the flag at midfield was a shot at him. A lot of the 49ers after the game were like, you know, talking about how happy they were that they kind of quieted Baker Mayfield. They were taunting him during the game. This is a weird spot for him where I've never seen him in a corner like this in the NFL. Now, granted, his whole life narrative is that this has been his story throughout and that he's been able to overcome it, but this is a different league and this is a very different situation.
Right. So the challenge of having the cockiness, the always being willing to dish it out is when you're not winning, what's your counter move, right? Whereas if you're just bland all the time, that works in any weather, right? And I think, as was discussed last year, the cockiness was a big reason that the Browns liked him, because you needed somebody that was going to come into a place where losing had been perpetual and try to change the culture and be cocky enough to believe that he could change the culture of a team that hadn't been to the playoffs in over a decade. But now you do wonder, how does he respond? What side of him do we see? Can you keep up the cockiness when you don't have the wins to back it up?
Baker, you should take a page from my book and just never get cocky, you know? I just can't ever remember a time like, you know, people were, you know, when we first started learning a lot about Baker Mayfield and said, that's what drives him. And he's a gamer and he talks trash. Like, I was just never able to do that. Not because I didn't feel that way inside, but probably because I was never good enough at anything to be able to be like, yeah, I'm beating you at this, you know? And you can't do that in writing. Like, I can't go back to the press box and slap a game story down on the thing and say, I just outwrote all of you guys.
Well, that's what Twitter is for. I mean,
oh, yeah, that's true.
There are definitely people in our business who have the Baker Mayfield cockiness.
For sure.
But you and I have always tried to subscribe to the undersell and overdeliver. I'm not saying that I overdeliver a lot, but I would rather aim to undersell and overdeliver.
Does that make us like sort of the Eli Mannings of journalism?
I don't know, Connor.
That's tough.
I like to think we have some juicier quotes from time to time. I'm not sure. But hey, listen, if we're two-time Super Bowl winners in our business, I think we're doing pretty well.
That's true. Very true. So this is an interesting topic here. The Cowboys have lost two straight games. And I remember when they were 3-0, a lot of talk was around this pending, to use Jerry Jones's words, contract extension with Dak Prescott. He was, if you're into total QBR, the best quarterback in football over the first 3 weeks of the season. That has since sort of slumped a little bit. Their schedule's gotten a lot more difficult. I thought it was interesting that after they lost to the Saints, a lot of Saints players said that, you know, we were trying to figure out how to stop Kellen Moore's offense, and we just went back and started watching Boise State games. We picked up a lot of stuff there. Mm-hmm. So now after losses to the Saints and the Packers, they're sitting at 3-2. Jerry Jones says that, Dak Prescott's price is not going to ebb and flow with every week of the season. That's not how you do business. I think that's probably a smart way to look at it. But if you're Prescott, do you worry that you didn't maybe take the deal that was on the table? If things get harder here and maybe you have to go in a different direction with the coaching staff, with anything that's going on here, are you concerned about maybe the fact that you didn't take the deal on the table?
Right. And that's always the concern when you're doing negotiations in season. And I think that's a lot of times why players and agents will table negotiations heading into the year, right?
Yeah.
This topic, by the way, is for a longtime friend of the MMQB, Dana Wright, who messaged me yesterday asking if we think that Dak is regressing like Trubisky. His reads and his accuracy have been terrible lately.
Great question.
I think it's a great question. I wish I had watched a little bit more. This is not a game that I saw a lot of on Sunday. I'm going to be 100% honest, Connor, mm-hmm. but you watched part of it.
Yeah, I think what the Saints are saying has merit, right? And I think that's almost a parallel to what we were saying about Baker Mayfield last year. It's really easy not easy. Easy is the wrong word. It's very effective to be in an offense with a good play caller that has no tendencies or track record, mm-hmm. right? And that was a huge bonus that you promote Kellen Moore from 1 year as quarterback's coach to offensive coordinator. And then all of a sudden, he's running a lot of the stuff that made him successful at Boise State, a lot of this college stuff that's trendier now, and a lot of stuff that Dak Prescott was probably familiar with from his own college days. You make him more comfortable. That's the thing, though. After 3 weeks in the NFL, you can start to catch on to some of that stuff. You can start to see maybe what they're doing. I don't think it's a regression. I think it's that offense just sort of coming back to the mean a little bit. Because
right.
there's really, I don't think we're going to see another situation like maybe the Chiefs and Andy Reid last year where they're unstoppable for an extremely long period of time. I think people are finally starting to catch up with a lot of this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting when you see offenses get to the point in the year where they hit a little bit of a speed bump.
Mm-hmm.
Like, unless you have that transcendent quarterback like Mahomes, like what you just described. Remember when the Chiefs hit that speed bump? What
yeah.
was that, 2 years ago? And they just couldn't hit the things they were hitting earlier, and they had looked on fire the first 5 weeks, and then all of a sudden they backslid a bit. So I think this is where the difference in the transcendent talent allows you to not have that regression, right?
So do you think that's an indicator of, you know, is it Dak Prescott in your mind, like, vacillating between transcendent and non-transcendent, or do you think that he's just good, right? He's in that good tier of quarterback.
Yeah, I think he's just good. That's where I would put him.
Another, like, personal reflective thing, you always just take the money on the table, you know? I'm always
right.
Staying, right?
Same. Oh, same. Definitely. Definitely. We're not betting big on, like, some, like, stocks here or risky stocks here. I think, you know, we're, like, going for the bonds, you know,
yeah.
just, like, chugging along.
This is a bonds podcast.
This is a bonds podcast. All right. Topic number five. The Washington football team fired its head coach earlier this week, and reports have already surfaced with a rather robust list of names, including Eric Bieniemy and Mike Tomlin. Is Daniel Snyder fooling himself, or do we actually think he's going to land a quality candidate in Washington? Zero chance.
Yeah, right?
I mean, this organization has had institutional failures for, what, 20 years? There's just... And the job is not appealing in any measure. It's not an appealing owner to work for. You don't get to pick the quarterback. He was picked in the first round a year ago. You know, I cannot imagine who they're going to get. And you would think, and generally in situations like this, you try to promote someone from within who is already in the building and would want the opportunity.
Which would be a
Bill Callahan,
yeah.
right? Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not sure if he would stay on. It's hard to think that they would be able to land a top external candidate.
I think for years, by default, you know, because there's only 32 of these jobs, they've sort of matched opportunity with desperation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's crazy that they've kind of hit twice, right? I mean, Mike Shanahan's staff had Sean McVay, Matt LaFleur, and who am I missing? There was a third.
Kyle Shanahan.
Yeah. And then I thought Jake Gruden was a good hire. I mean, mm-hmm. he took them to the playoffs. And this, despite all this organizational dysfunction over Kirk Cousins, you know, I think offensively he's a good mind. Shout out to Andy Benoit, who said that he thinks he'd be the first offensive coordinator that he'd hire this offseason if Jake Gruden was interested in being an offensive coordinator. If I was a coach, and this might be my first and only opportunity to have the job, I'd stay a million miles away from this job, right?
Right.
I mean, there's just no reason to stake your personal reputation on a quarterback that the owner is clearly interested in seeing developed, but you didn't pick. Mm-hmm. It's terrifying. I think it's a very scary job.
It's a scary job. And, you know, we've talked on this podcast about the situation that the Dolphins are in, where they're going with this long-term rebuild. I would rather sign up for that than what Washington has, right? Because at least you know in that situation... The first year is going to be painful, and there are questions about how that affects your ability to survive it long term. Totally valid questions. But at least you think, okay, be able to pick some of these players that we're getting, we're stockpiling draft picks, be able to pick a quarterback, be able to pick the cornerstones of the franchise. And the problem is in Washington, you have a quarterback who might be good. You know, he may be good, but you don't get to pick him. And you also know, based on reports, that the owner had a large hand in picking him. So the owner is getting very involved in draft picks, which is not happening in Miami, right? The owner's not involved with draft picks there. So I think it's hard to see a path to success there. That's why I think unless it's somebody who is just so desperate to get back in, but I don't know, maybe they could just go head coachless.
Interesting. you know what's weird is their rebuild hasn't even started yet, right? And they're gonna need to at some point. Like, that whole roster, very veteran laden, very expensive talent there, that's all gotta come teared down. And then you gotta build back up around Haskins, who may at some, you know, be in his third, fourth, or fifth year by then. Are you really still gonna stick with them? I mean, I don't know. I think that's I liken coaching in Washington to, like, if you buy the worst house in the neighborhood, right? And then you start weeding the house, and you're cleaning up all the landscape, and you're like, okay, I finally got all that done. And then the roof caves in. And then you go try to fix the roof, and then you're done fixing the roof, but then the weeds have come back, right? And then, you know, there's just no end in sight, you know what I mean? No positive future.
And then perhaps, just as a hypothetical, there's a temperature change in the lake and all the fish end up dead. Just purely hypothetical, Connor.
And that's, you know, that's life.
This was a real thing that happened to Connor recently, through no fault of his own.
I didn't kill the fish, yeah, but my backyard, I was telling this to Jenny the other day, I walked outside and I thought that all the leaves had fallen down from the trees, and I thought, that's weird, because they're not red or yellow, but it's early. And then I went out into my backyard and there was hundreds of dead fish. It smelled like an old Red Lobster out there.
In the pond, to
in
be
the
clear.
Pond. Yeah.
They weren't like...
Not in my backyard.
Not
it wasn't
in
like
your
biblical.
Backyard,
yeah,
but
they didn't.
The pond is in your backyard. And then the dead fish were
in the pond.
In the pond. But still, requiring a massive cleanup effort, which sources tell me Orr took on largely by himself.
Waiting for the thanks from the neighbors from that one.
Maybe,
put on the waiters.
Some of your neighbors listen to the podcast.
That's true. Maybe we'll get a gift bag or something
like
that. Just don't put any seafood in it. I'm obviously turned off to that. After that experience. So I guess based on my success from the Oracle last week, I'm feeling a little froggy. I will say this, and I mentioned what I wrote about the Raiders, that yes, it was a very obvious thing to predict that they were going to try to stop Khalil Mack, right? I mean, that is not a very difficult thing to predict.
But you specifically
right?
predicted that they would triple team him.
That's true.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, let's give yourself a little credit.
Yeah, yeah. I'll give myself a little credit. So this one, I'm feeling a little froggy. I'm going to go way out on a limb here.
Okay.
I just put Falcons in the show notes because I wanted to surprise you.
Right, I'm curious.
Atlanta Falcons are 1-4 right now. Dan Quinn, if you read some of the hot takeier sites, is now the next favorite coach to be dismissed in the regular season, although owner Arthur Blank said it's not going to happen. I think they're going to be 500 by Thanksgiving, and I think that they're going to compete for a playoff spot this year. I think in December we will have substantive discussions about a 1-4 turned around Falcons team in the hunt for the playoffs.
Wow. That is going out on a limb, Connor. What makes you think that?
I think, you know, it's just one of those things where you look at the league and you say, like, what's broken here? Like, what's mm-hmm. not performing the way that it should? And I feel like the Falcons just keep spinning their wheels. And we've heard this horrible analogy from coaches 1,000 times, right? But then finally the tire treads catch ground and you're off. And I think that this is a team that's just so talented. They're just way too talented to just fritter out the rest of the season, and then we'd never hear from them again. I don't know.
Well, they got the Cardinals next, but then after that, they've got the Rams, Seahawks, and Saints.
You need those statement victories,
okay?
Right?
Because interesting.
The climb has got to be difficult to propel them forward.
Okay.
You know? And with the Cardinals, when I was working on my predictions, I was going to predict a team to massively turn itself around. I knew that's what I wanted to do for the predictions. The Cardinals are interesting because they got their first win, and I think they have a kind of a softer schedule moving forward. Like, they could get to 500 faster than the Falcons could. That actually wouldn't surprise me either.
All right. Well, you could save that one for next week's Oracle.
That's
depending
right.
Depending on how things go.
Well, I think we should end the show in my favorite way, to end the show, which is, you know, we tell you guys this all the time. It's better to agree. That's what this podcast is for. It's for sports people who like to be sports friends and share opinions, not because everybody should have the same like-minded opinion, but because you should come together on certain things, and that's why we have the Vrentis consensus.
This is a true community builder here, Connor.
Yes, I agree.
That my thought this week is that gluten-free beer is fantastic.
Yes.
Because, you know, this was a long week at Sports Illustrated. If there was ever a week to imbibe on beverages you hadn't tried for a while, this was a great week to do it. So we ended up at a bar a couple blocks away last Thursday night to celebrate the careers of some of those colleagues let go. And there were two options of gluten-free beers on the menu.
Wow.
And there was a third option that said gluten removed. So I'm not quite sure what that was. I picked one of the options, which was some kind of ale. And it was huge. It was like $9 for this giant, like, wine bottle sized beer.
Really?
Yeah. And it was excellent. I think that gluten-free products probably in most cases fairly get a bad rap, but gluten-free beer is not one of them. So if you, like me, happened to need a drink this week, I would try gluten-free beer.
When was the last time you had a beer prior to that?
Probably the last gluten-free beer I had, which was maybe 3 years ago.
Okay.
So it's very rare. Yeah, very rare.
That's good, though. You see, I think that, you know, because, we do the Bad Football Movies podcast.
Right.
Where, we come in during the summer and we have all of our good friends in and we get alcoholic products and we watch bad football movies and we tape ourselves talking about it. And I've always felt, you know, not bad because, you know, we did Rosé, the one episode, which was fun.
Yeah.
But then there was another colleague that I didn't know was gluten-free and I felt really bad about it. And I'm glad that gluten-free beer is not only, you know, making a charge, but is actually good, right? Because
right.
You're a connoisseur of the good versus the bad gluten-free. We've talked about this before.
Right. So now beer is another category to add to that list. A true consensus builder, Connor.
I'm so excited. Thank you guys so much for listening this week. The MMQB Weekside Podcast is me, Connor Orr, and Jenny Vrentis. We are produced by Shelby Royston. SI's executive producer of podcasts is Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is the director of editorial projects and product. Mark, Tim, Andy, John, we love you guys. We miss you guys. Thanks again for everything. Thanks again for everything that you've done for us, and we'll try to make you guys proud moving forward. And keep up with our entire line of podcasts. We're doing this 5 days a week on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a review. It really does help other people find the show. And it's also available on Spotify, Radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you find your podcasts.